5 o'clock.
Welcome to Shattered Lives, a lively, educational, and issues-driven radio show designed to tell another side of the story, to focus on and humanize crime victims, to enlighten and shine the spotlight on organizations and service providers, and to assist those who walk the path with us. This is Donna R. Gore, a.k.a. Lady Justice, your host, with my co-host, Delilah Jones, president of Imagine Publicity.com, welcoming you this evening and every evening, every Saturday evening, every week across the nation and across the neighborhood to enlighten, inform, to increase awareness, and educate and hopefully entertain you. And so I welcome you on this chilly Saturday evening, this fall evening in November from Connecticut. And we also have the benefit of having people from multiple states. And I say good evening to Delilah Jones from South Carolina. Good evening, Delilah. How are you? Are you keeping warm?
It's kind of chilly down here, too, Donna, for us anyway.
I know.
The cold front has come south. Yeah.
I know. And I believe... We have a very special guest this evening. One woman that I've had sort of on the back burner, and we kind of rose the material from the ashes, and we kind of borrowed her from Dr. Scott Vaughn, he was very gracious to kind of share her. And tonight we're going to focus on ethical issues, aging, mental health with regard to prisoners. And I know it's a kind of a controversial topic if you're listening and you're a crime victim, but hey, it is what it is, and you know, this show doesn't shy away from a controversy. Delilah, would you like to make an introductory comment before I introduce our guest about this? What do you think?
Well, I think it's definitely a topic that is under-discussed. I haven't heard too many people talking about it. And, you know, usually you present one side or the other on an issue and so forth. But with our guest tonight and you're kind of coming at it from two different types of experience, you know. Donna,
right.
For the listening audience that doesn't know, lost her father to murder several decades ago, and the murderer is incarcerated. And I don't know, I think you can speak from experience, and this conversation should be very enlightening for the listeners to know what your experience is, how you feel about the person who's aging in prison who
right.
murdered your father.
Right, and like I say, I don't think it's our mission to always agree with our guests, but it's our mission to present all sides so that we can inform our audience, and I think it's a matter of evolvement. Perhaps, you know, I don't feel as intensely as I might have 30 something years ago, but well, you know, after I hear what Tina has to say, you know, who knows, maybe my initial opinion will evolve. So without further ado, and I hope I don't, Tina, I hope I don't mess up your last name, Dr. Tina Mashi, is that correct?
That's the way I say
it. Oh, thank you. Good guess. Dr. Tina Mashi, that's PhD, not MD, is an LCSW and ACSW and associate professor at Fordham University Graduate School of Social Work in New York. She's also president of the National Organization of Forensic Social Work. She has done numerous types of research, particularly with aging, mental health, and the criminal justice system. She is also lead author of the book Social Worker and Researcher Integrating Research with Advocacy. And I have been reading up on, you know, she, I'm very akin in my beliefs to social work. It's practically what I do at my real job with state government, although they don't call me one. And you try to help people, you try to change the world. And we know we can't change the world en masse. So Tina came up with this wonderful idea to try to change thought patterns rather than changing the masses. And I believe, correct me if I'm wrong, Tina, you're the executive director of Be the Evidence Project, which advances human rights, social justice, and increases health and well-being. And, you know, this what you kind of thought of in regard to trying to make a change in the world was rather groundbreaking from what I can gather. So you are a woman for all citizens and all populations, and so I think it's wonderful to have you. So it's a long-winded way of saying thank you for being with us on Shattered Life. It's a pleasure to have you this evening.
Well, Donna, Delilah, thank you so much for having me. It's an honor to be on your show.
Well, thank you. Same here. It's a pleasure to have you. You know, I just wanted to touch on, before we get into the meat of the matter with human rights and prisoner aging and whatnot, this whole idea that you had with regard to Be the Evidence Project and the fact that we can't affect societal change en masse. So you came up with the idea of disseminating information, research information, very quickly so that you get it out to the masses rather than waiting for a position paper to be published, and that would take 2 years, and that just seems like, you know, a snail's pace. And then by the time you get it on paper, things are much different. Can you give us an example of if your project deals with human rights, social justice, and increasing health and well-being, what would be some examples of what you deal with respect to those categories?
We have several divisions. One is called Aging, Health, and Human Rights, Aging, and Health, okay? So we have several sub-projects within that, and one is called Aging in the Criminal Justice System. And that really is an ongoing project that will continue to build, because if you're aging the criminal justice, you could have been victimized by in the context of a crime, or you could have committed a crime at an earlier time in your life, and you're aging in prison, or you could have committed a crime later in life. So it deals with both people who have been victims and have committed a crime. And it also looks at the impact of the environment on health. And we know that social environments such as poverty-stricken neighborhoods, stricken with community violence, the health outcomes are going to be very different. There's more health disparities among those groups compared to those groups that live in safer communities and with a higher income level. And then the same thing holds true for prison, which is another social environment. They find that people who are aging in prison, there's an accelerated aging process that happens, that if you're age 50 in prison, your biological age is almost 15 years more, meaning age 65, you've got that type of health status. And so somebody aging 50 in prison versus someone 65 in the community, their health status is about the same in terms of biological. Well, the chronological age, you can throw that out. And although they say that prior to prison does influence health, including the environment you came from and the way you practice health practice, had access to health care services, I do think, as our discussion goes on, the social environmental conditions of prison are unhealthy and a real stressor. They're violent. Many prisons are violent, that it takes a toll on health. So I think that's important to think about, that there's a social environment that does affect our health. And I'm a social worker. We've been pitching that all along since the birth of our profession, turn of the century. This is news to other professions and community members. If you're typically going to your medical doctor when it's all about physical health and not necessarily the social environment. So that's an evolution. And I do want to also mention, too, because this is an important part of one of our subdivisions, divisions, we have the Arts for Healing and Transformation. And a lot of the projects we do in terms of rapid dissemination have to do with short documentaries. We did talk briefly before the show that to provide a song that I wrote, because I'm a professional musician before I got into academia, and it's called We Are All Aging Prisoners, and brings up these moral and ethical dilemmas that we'll discuss. But I invite listeners to go to the website link for the radio show and click on that and really think about the issues that are raised when a crime happens. There's often a victim and an offender. What do we do about that? That's a relational issue, and we often leave both parties without the abilities or avenues for restoration and reconciliation and healing,
right,
which also has health effects. And the biggest thing which is of interest, when I look at life course trauma, they find it people in later life, if you have untreated, undetected trauma, that's going to impact your health and well-being in later life in terms of your physical and mental health. But what's a resiliency factor among them is having external social support. But the other thing is having internal resources, and one of which is I would classify as a spiritual practice, and that's forgiveness. Those that, including Holocaust survivors that experienced the most egregious crimes against humanity, against themselves and their families, and those in later life that reported having forgiveness towards their perpetrators, actually fared better in later life.
That's very interesting. I think we have a lot of things with regard to, I've been told by numerous guests that my resiliency is very high, having had over 50 surgeries in my life prior to, you know, homicide and all of these different things. Like, you know, you kind of go with the flow, and you know your tolerance for things is very high, and you can somehow find a way to cope. Now, also, you know, prisoners on the other end of the spectrum, a lot of them are very intelligent people, and they, especially those that have, you know, had a long history of crime, they must have found some mechanisms by which they had, you know, been able to survive and commit these crimes, and then at some point in time got incarcerated. And but what is it, Tina, about, is it the seclusion aspect, or, you know, the quote-unquote environmental deprivation that really, you know, accelerates things in terms of the aging, and maybe they might have something that's kind of festering and then it suddenly becomes a full-blown physical problem?
I do think the social environment can exacerbate any condition. I do have some verbatim quotes. You can hear it from the people in prison, the kinds of situations that are going on, because I think it's very powerful to hear from them. The one thing I do want to say that to the audience, that my deepest empathy and for the, anyone who's experienced the loss of a loved one, especially if it was an unexpected death or injury to someone. This is very it's a very difficult issue, and I absolutely resonate with that, and I've worked with a lot of people who have been either victims of crime or had a family member, and it is difficult, and I'm you know, clear about that. And with my work inside prisons, the thing is that the same group who we call offenders or prisoners, but they engaged in behavior that ended up hurting and maybe resulted in the loss of life, but many of them have histories of trauma. And in the study that I did in New Jersey, I had of 677 older people in prison, age 15 older, they, on average, they reported 3 lifetime traumatic or stressful life experiences, and including 80% reported being witnessing or victims to family or community violence. And so we're talking about almost everyone. 4 out of 5 are reporting that they experienced this, and yet there is nothing there to help them. So this disenfranchised, unaddressed grief and loss and traumatic symptoms may impact decision-making processes that people may choose, may not...
The path of crime?
Or to their coping capacities might be challenged, in which they engage in issues. And also the other thing I do want to say, that not everybody in prison is there in a fair and just way. We know that there's a disproportionate confinement of minority people, African Americans, Latinos, compared to whites. And not everybody has committed the crime that they have been convicted of.
And unlawfully convicted people. We know of some very good prime examples of that as well. But from the standpoint of a crime victim, and I'm going to play the devil's advocate here because I guess I am the devil in this conversation. When you've had someone killed in a homicide, you know, and typically the stereotype, whether it be on a television show or in real life, you know, the defense attorney will come up and they'll say, "Oh, but Your Honor, you know, this defendant, you know, he had an abusive childhood and a neglectful childhood and this and that and whatever," and the victim's family doesn't want to hear that because they're so focused upon their own loss. They don't see how that impacts upon the defendant. In fact, I'm sure it does, but we are so focused on our own grief and our loss, we really don't care about that because we focus on the fact in the heat of the moment and for years after that they took a life, and that is the most important thing. So who cares, you know? There, and then we can see chapter and verse of many, many other people that grew up in, shall we say, substandard, impoverished circumstances that did not result in crime.
Right.
So what do you say about that?
Yeah, and I think that's a good point. And part of our conversation today is just to begin dialoguing about this because we haven't been. The two sides have not been talking to each other. Victim services and correctional services, and you know, they have people deeply and advocates that are very passionate on both sides, including the family members. And I would say you're correct that not everyone who has had a similar profile has gone on to commit a crime, and so that's a good point. And I would also say that experiencing loss, especially when there's been a significant violation and the loss of a family member, it's part of a process. There's the stages of grief, the death and loss, and where you're at in that process at that point in time may not be the same process that you're going to be in a later point in time. Look at the Holocaust survivors. Look at them. I mean, if we could go into the details of that, they're horrific genocide of many different groups based on race, religion, sexual orientation. So they have found a path to, you can't necessarily change circumstances. You can change, you can choose to manage
to
it
change
whatever
your thinking
way.
About, oh, yeah, over and, time and forgiveness.
I think it would be great if people called in and to see, you know, to talk about what their process has been, because I've heard from other people that have lost a family member, including someone who's their husband who's a police officer, that actually has been practicing restorative justice and been in contact with the man who killed her husband.
Right.
And actually speaks on behalf of those in incarcerated people. And that's,
but we have had those guests as well. I mean, they are out there, but I don't know that everyone, even if you have a strong faith or you don't have a strong faith, or you have a spirituality about you, you know, maybe over time, if that's what you choose to do, because you are seeing that this tremendous loss, it's taking its toll upon your mind and your body, and you feel as if, in my opinion, these are the people that, for whatever reason, their genetic makeup, their ability to cope, cannot rely on their resilience to get them through. So they know that this is eating them up inside, and you know, so they have to do something else, or else they will not survive themselves. I'm not particularly a religious person. You know, and I'm sorry, I don't have much empathy for the offender, the prisoner that murdered my father. We just went through a board of pardons and parole hearing about a year and a half ago that never should have been done legally. And, you know, I can't tell you, I was so concerned for my 82-year-old mom, because she was, you know, looking for some sign of remorse, some sign of recognition of who we were after, you know, 30-something years, and it just wasn't there, and that's the most heartbreaking thing. So, you know, I think the prisoner as well has to have it within themselves to say, yes, I want to be forgiven, I want to make contact with the victim's families. Tina, what percentage is it of prisoners that are able to also take that step forward for them, their own self-healing?
You know, this is a good point. We don't necessarily know that, you know, in terms of the exact numbers, but I mm-hmm. work with people who have been victimized by crimes, but also people who are in prison mm-hmm. in the New York, New Jersey systems, and there are rules that, one, they're not allowed to write the victims' families.
Right.
So in terms of seeking reconciliation, so that may not be an avenue that they can, because it's against the rules. And so they might want to, and there are a number of people that do grow the same as just like their process, and accepting their transgressions and finding a way for self-compassion and forgiveness, because you can't change something that one has done, but you can begin to think about how to do things differently. And having worked in prisons for over 15 years, and in the studies that I'm doing, prisons aren't conducive for rehabilitation. So if someone can, if there's no contact and nowhere to process crimes, then it might be difficult to do on one's own, because there's not the services to help them get back on their feet, or to help understand the process that led them to do something that hurt another individual or family or community. And so,
right.
So there's
Gina,
the system's almost a and it's not serving people who have lost a family member, because the system is not providing them the services to help them process the situation. So nobody's getting anything. And there are some instances where people who have been victimized by a crime or lost a family member want some type of contact with the person who committed a crime, and that's not necessarily allowed. These are unresolved issues.
Tina, how do we find a way to bring both sides to the table to have the dialogue open up, just like, you know, we're having on a mini session right now, so that these instances can be more proactive instead of reactive, and hopefully somewhere down the line maybe prevent certain crimes from happening. Where do we stand as on this particular issue, and how do we correct it?
Well, I would say that it would be great to have both parties, both sides, if we're going by sides, because honestly, with the aging people in prison, I can't, and I write about this all the time, they report significant amount of being victimized in their life. And I can read you a couple of quotes where I get the solutions. But, and I'll give you just short clips. I'm happy to share with readers if they want longer clips. But one man wrote to me that I was sexually assaulted when I was 13. I never really trusted anyone after that, tried to get even when I was a Marine, but it was a pyrrhic victory at a devastating cost to me. So he's attributing this early trauma, of which he's clearly a victim, and he's a child. Another man writes, I was crippled when I was younger. My family member beat and molested me. I was tied to basement poles, beaten always, told over and over again, you're a jailbird just like your father. This was so tightly put into my head, it blurred everything I saw. So these are the kinds of things that happen prior.
Very early on.
Right. And then there's people with mental health issues who go to service systems, and the way they're treated in the service systems, they commit a crime to get in prison, and they're actually treated better there. And so
they work the system to be able to get services. What is it? That's bastardizing the, you know, our systems are so unworkable, really. I mean, to have to do that to get treatment, I mean, what's wrong with that picture? Everything is wrong with that, isn't it?
It is, and so we have to say, okay, well, there is this history. Maybe we don't have, you know, empathy, because not, like we talk about, that everyone does, but there are mitigating factors that, in terms of court, sometimes it's not about what either party feels, because you could have someone who committed the crime who their family feels a particular way, too, about what they think is fair. And if the way sentences are going, they're not proportionately giving out across similar people who committed the same crime. So that's an issue that goes, that's another issue. And then other things about the situation in prison. And then the length of sentence, that's the question. I'm just getting to some.
How do you feel that privatizing the prison system has affected these issues?
I'll get to that when we talk about sitting the parties down together and then get to private, because I actually work for a private company inside a prison. But when in prison, and we're talking about older people, so if someone served 25, 30 years sentences or longer, or they're getting old and their health is, they're terminally ill and they're close to dying and diagnosed with terminal illness, whether it be cancer, 6 months to live. But there's things that happen in prison where people are witnessing a correctional officer stomping inmates into comas, getting dumped by gangs. This is an epidemic. So it's a totally violent place. And you think about it, is this really going to rehabilitate people? Are we making it even more difficult for them to find the pathway to redemption when we're putting them in
We're warehousing them instead of, do they have, I mean, in our state, they had a contract with University of Connecticut Medical Center to treat people. There's so many prisoners in our state that had mental health problems and physical problems, and you know, and it turned into more of a medical model versus a, you know, restrictive penal model, and that's what I'm saying. Do they are if we're privatizing, or is it a wave of the future to actually have, like sometimes when they do a developmentally disabled, what we used to call severely retarded, to have skilled nursing units within the organization so that they can actually get the skilled treatment? Do we have, you know, just like we have Alzheimer's or dementia units in hospitals, do we have skilled nursing facility units somewhere where they could actually get the treatment they need?
Some do, but not a lot. But a lot of, you'll hear stories about medical neglect where, and sometimes treatment is withheld if staff don't like you. And people are raped if they're older in prison. And it's, when we talk about elder abuse and elder justice, it's not necessarily extended to older people in prison. When someone's raped, regardless of what they do, are they deserving of the same treatment? I do want to address first the how do we get the sides together, and then the private prisons. Well, you know, just like any dialogue, any when there's conflict, there's a stage conflict resolution where parties, if they're ready and willing, if they feel like the way things have been going, the way that we've been dividing and fragmenting systems and separating people that are on the crime happens in a relational context, whether you knew the person or not, and having the separation hasn't necessarily fixed things. And so if there are some individuals or groups that are willing to sit down and have talks about where to find common ground, because I think some of the common ground would be, we want to stop crime from happening. We don't want this to happen to other people. That might be a common ground among certain groups. Or they don't, you know, if this crime didn't happen, we wouldn't be talking about how long people should stay in prison. So if victim services and correctional services would sit down together, there are some models, like in Vermont, they do a lot of restorative justice practices,
right.
And they've come a long way. And I actually was at a conference up there and heard very profound stories from a mother who lost her son to drunk, a young person killed her son in a car accident when he was drinking. And they actually go around doing presentations. I'm actually getting chills when I talk about it. They go around doing presentations together, her and the son, the man that killed the young man,
right,
killed the son. And for
that,
her, it was very profound. And so, you know, this could be a one-on-one where people find their way if that's what they need to do. The important thing is find your path. But I think that groups could get together, because what happens, when, say, with adult protective services, when people are coming out of prison, they might need those services, because the stories with reentry, these older people, not only were they possibly victimized in prison, but when they come out in the community, at that point they've served their sentence. They're done. They paid their debt to society, and they may fall victim to a crime. If they're in a shelter, if they're homeless because they have nowhere to live.
More vulnerable, yes.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Or they have cognitive
problems,
you know. So I think sitting down, and I would say there's two ways, you know, the three of us could do. We could do a follow-up show where we had a dialogue with different victim services or, you know, family members if they want to begin a discussion of what it's like. And you might find that there's common ground about the loss of the family member, the family members that did not commit the crime, if the person that did, are suffering. There's a lot of suffering going on.
Mm-hmm. You know, we haven't really addressed the numbers just for in context with our audience. I know in the pre-show post, Delilah had put in there, there are 246,000 men and women over 50, and I guess that's considered
older
That's
considered
people. Elderly, right.
Elderly. Oh, excuse me. I'm very elderly then. I'm almost in the next decade. okay. In the prison system, who now are those considered to have some type of diagnosable physical and or mental health issue to say these are things that are not being addressed at all or not being addressed appropriately? Is that number correct as of 2014?
I would say that of the aging or the people with mental health and physical health issues, with mental and physical health, I would say that any statistics are probably underestimating because
they're always older.
Yeah, they're older and also detecting problems within prison if they didn't have it before prison and they didn't pick it up. They might get health issues, and they may not detect and identify, especially with related to cognitive impairment, where dementia is 5 times higher than in prisons than in the general public. Then it's costly. It's costly. It costs 3 times more for keep aging people in prison. Typical statistics around 78,000 compared to younger counterparts of 22,000. They just cost a lot. Like if any of our aging parents out there, health and mental health become significant issues as you advance in age that need to be addressed. So we have these pseudo nursing homes that are prisons that were not designed
and they're not
to be.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, and they're not equipped. And the audience just has to ask themselves, there's cost to this. You really want to spend that amount of money in a system that's, if they pose no danger to society, especially if they're physically so ill that they've lost the capacity to move, to talk, to, and they don't even remember their crime because they have dementia. There's a purpose for us to spend that money there.
Right.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and then the other thing is, moral issues, and I encourage everybody to listen to the song I wrote. It's not taking a position, it's just asking questions. Do you think it's right? Such as the example of a woman who might kill her husband in self-defense because she's been a victim of domestic violence for 10 or more years, a long time. And finally she snaps and she kills her husband, not necessarily intentionally, and she gets 20 to life. Is this, so we need to look at just beyond that there's a murder charge, we have to think because there's a murder charge and sometimes it's in self-defense. And so I just ask people to think about it. I think about it too. And I don't necessarily say I have the answer, but I'm willing to dialogue with people. How can we come to some situation where people's who have grief, I think of the film Dead Man's Walking, where we have the family that lost their son and daughter to crime, and how they were processing that. That's something to think about. How do we deal with that?
Well,
and then the family of the person committed the murder.
Mm-hmm.
Where would we as society be able to draw the line as far as humanitarian release? I can't imagine somebody like Charles Manson being released on a human, humanitarian release. This person is good enough, and this one's not good enough. How do we get to that point, and what criteria do we use?
Yeah, that's a good point.
If they're incapacitated.
Well, people do come up for parole, and there might be some black and white areas where this person, yes, they should leave, be a parole from prison, and maybe this person is not. Although we talk about in my forensic social work class that I teach at Fordham, we talk about Charles Manson and his health capacity. He's actually getting to the point where it is up there. And he might be, in terms of if we took a poll among the audience, maybe there'd be a certain percentage that would say do not release them, and maybe 80-90% would say don't release them. But then there might be other people where if there's not a one-size-fits-all. We can't think that everybody is Charles Manson. And, you know, that,
but release
so
them to where, though, Tina? If there's no real resource that can deal with their problems, then they're better off staying where they are.
That's what I'm saying.
You can't put them in a homeless shelter. I work with people who are blind and physically and visually impaired, and several of them at different points have been homeless. It's very dangerous to have a totally blind person go to a homeless shelter. And, you know, that's what I'm saying. So, you know, if you're just going to put them out there and they're not going to have the resources to protect themselves and to protect society, then,
Now that's, to me, and that's a scary thought to me, because I pretty much see when people, the stories people are telling me, if they get out of prison, when prison is actually considered a safer place than the, or better place in the community, what are we doing out here? What are we are our own prison. There's no difference. All this treatment of each other is happening no matter where you're at. So it's not necessarily prisons. it's the community's actually considered worse. Now, that to me suggests we need to clean up our act. So it's not necessarily the building. It's not a prison. It's not a home where people could stay if they need shelter because they don't have a place to live. It's the attitudes that pervades that are running the place. It's not the building. We could take a prison and we can call it the House of Freedom. And, you know, it's just what you call it, what it is. And it's my hope that if somebody committed a crime, it could be a drug crime. They were addicted to a drug, and I have actually a video that you can link to where there's a man who got into a fight with someone, and it didn't have intention to kill the man, but he fell in a way that it killed him. So he served, I think his latest sentence was over 25 years. But we don't want people to have to come out and do drugs again and then possibly get into the same situations if they're not providing services. Then that accident might happen again and we might lose someone else. And if I'm a bystander, if I'm looking, you can be a bystander, you can be an upstander. And we could say, you know, the death and loss of people in our community, this is enough. We need to make it stop. So, and part of it might be considering providing support to people that chose to engage in behaviors that hurt people. And there's a lot of people that are in prison that come out and they're actually exemplary citizens, leaders that help a lot of people. And I work with a lot of formerly incarcerated people that are really doing their best to try to help. And if you think about the dying in prison, who's taking care of it? I can read quotes of the treatment of, and I've worked in prisons and see the way that the dying were treated in prison. And it was the people who with the murder charges that were helping, not the staff that were paid, that took ethical oaths.
That's part of a program to help counsel them to other people, right? Other prisoners, if they choose to do that. But what is, in your view, and with your research, is compassion proportional to the crime committed? I mean, do people tend to be more compassionate if it's a quote and forgive? And I know I'm broad brushing this, but in relation to a lesser crime versus say, a homicide?
I would say that the public attitudes and fears that most people are afraid of violent crimes and sex crimes. But when we start to peel apart, if you just say murder or we say sex offense, you know, we think of probably in our head the most egregious sex offense, but it could be something lesser. Fondling as opposed to ongoing anal intercourse with a young girl. So there's a real diversity, but we have fear. It's like this aging in prison crisis. if we have fear of violence and crime, if we've got that, that the aging prison population, large portion of those with the violent offenses that have the long-term sentences. And racial disparities, if we've got this ongoing racial tension and fear of racial ethnic groups different than our own, then that's going to be fear that pervades. And there also fear of aging, fear of dying. It's all, you know, like to me, this is the aging in prison is a symbol of our time, of everything we fear. We don't want to look at. First, we're probably most people are concerned to consciously keep them there, so it's just out of our sight, so we don't have to look at these things that we fear the most.
Right. Well, a couple things I can think of are that a couple points is that if I were faced with the murder of my father and he had a terminal illness, you know, many crime victims have a visceral reaction to the person, and it's so deep and upsetting that they just cannot get over that in order to overcome and be compassionate enough to say, okay, well, let's let them out because they have, you know, a progressive disease or whatnot. I just think it's going to be only a certain percentage and a small percentage of crime victim families who are going to be able to make that leap of faith to say, okay, you know, well, he can't do any harm anymore, so let's do this because there's nothing that even the balance here. This person, I don't have anything left of my loved one, and I never will. And many times, the thing that struck me, Tina, is that the person that killed my father was a multiple offender. He had no clue who my father was, who the family was, any of our names. He had no identity. Whereas, you know, this was just a number to him, or a means to an end to get drugs, to do whatever. And when it is so generic like that, I don't know that people emotionally can let go and forgive to that extent. Now, like I say, maybe there are that small percentage. And then the other thing I wanted to mention was that I think your point about dialoguing and getting together and having people do one-on-one, meetings where you might achieve some restitution. Grassroots organizations are very good. Nonprofits, they do the cutting edge work. But when you try to introduce this into governmental entities like prisons and institutions, that's where you encounter these barriers. And I just think, you know, we have good ideas about what to implement, but when you get into to institutions and governments, those are the entities that put the kibosh on all of the good ideas and, no, that's not how we run things, and we have rules, and that's not going to work, and et cetera. So, I mean, I don't know.
Well,
I don't know where this
ends
up.
Yeah, well, I tell you, one thing I learned about working with in prisons as a licensed clinical social worker and doing research is that the creativity within confinement. Think about, you could be in a cell and confined for 23 hours a day, and people have found ways to be very creative and actually become very evolved in terms of their human and spiritual development, very inspirational. And so applying it to here is that we can find ways around that. I do resonate with people, you know, have to be with their process. If you've lost a family member and may not want somebody to get out of prison, but the thing is, the reality is that somebody might get paroled. So what we want or don't want in life may not go the way that we want it to. So
of
that
course.
Person might be paroled.
Right.
Yeah,
but
so that might be just something.
Anyway.
Right. So, and that's just part of the justice system when they're balancing, you know, issues of justice and fairness, and whether one party feels violated that this was not a fair and just disposition. But it might happened. So what do you do with it then? The other thing I think about, and this is with the people in prison, is that you do have your the older people in prison often serve as mentors to the younger people, where they help to turn them around. So this is a very powerful force that actually are helping to rehabilitate younger people. And don't we want these younger people also to get out? So we don't want them to commit a crime, because it could be another family member or friend or somebody else that might get victimized. Somebody has issues that they didn't get a chance to. You know, services were provided while in prison, or education, or employment opportunities where they can't, or they can't get housing because they have a sex offense, that the probability of them committing crime. So to me, part of the system is the problem. And that's where people who have been victimized and who have committed offenses have been both wronged in some ways. That we don't have a society that cares enough for one another. We lost sight of our moral compass. But the other thing about the peer mentors within the community there, where they're teaching each other, and to what extent within the people who are survivors or families who lost a family member, where they're survivors of crime, where they're working with people at different parts of their process. And people need to be where they're at and have their ground about how they feel about some of the perpetrated crime against a family member, against them. But if there are different people within that community with diversity of opinion and experiences, are they getting together, and to what extent to share? Because that whole peer support piece is real big and helpful. And the other thing is, even if it's minority of people whose families feel like, and there are some, because I hear stories, let the guy out, we don't want him in anymore, but they still won't let him out. Like, the family wants him out, and they're not being heard.
Right.
So the family not being heard, no matter what their views are. Their views are their views, and it should be heard. And I'm not quite sure how well the system is dealing with that. Because you don't want somebody out, they get out,
or vice
versa. They're
not equipped to handle that kind of response and say, okay, they want him out, so we'll find a way. I don't think the penal system has evolved that much to be able to handle that unique situation. And, you know, two things that I wanted to ask. Since you work with both populations, or you're teaching students and you're working with families of crime at some percentage, and you're working with prisoners, do you try to remain neutral in your thought process? How do you do it if you're working with both populations?
Well, in typical in any kind of social work or counseling type of situation is empathy. It's listening to someone's story. And I can hear and embrace their perceptions about, you know, their situation and where they're at in that process. I don't need to necessarily change that unless it's something they want to, or maybe it's mandated counseling and substance abuse, but they have to, you know, follow some kind of guideline, you know, their mental health court, and then they need to go to prison. Well, you know, using some motivational interviewing skills to have to move them along that chain to maybe see why it might be good to, or evolve within themselves, why it might be good to stop doing drugs, because otherwise they might go to prison. I would like to just engage, like, my personal views. I just would like to engage in this dialogue because it's really important. I don't like to see suffering on any side. And so I hear the cries of both sides, and that's why I'm thankful to have the conversation with both of you this evening and with your audience, so we can talk about it, because I feel it. I worked with, this is my whole life, I've worked with trauma in one way or another.
What would you have to say with regard to, you know, I can see that you're very open to making change on a one-to-one or a basis, or, you know, small groups and all of that. And I think that is very doable. It, within the backdrop here, the elephant in the room that we're not talking about is, our society We just had families from Newtown testify that the 2-year anniversary report is coming up. Although we're making some ground in small ways, in pockets like this, our society is going crazy with regard to these mass shootings. So when you're talking about making relative progress in these small areas, and then you look at society as a whole, and we have all these massacres, as a social worker, what do you have to say about that?
Well,
We're not learning from our past mistakes.
Yeah. How much violence do we need because we're so inundated with it, and on top of mass disasters that we've seen that we're at the negligence of trained professionals, missing planes, people aborting ships where hundreds and hundreds of children drown. Maybe it's because we have mass media. We're inundated with how the lack of respect we have for others and our decision-making processes when it comes to safety of the community, that this is like a wake-up call. And the aging people in prison issue, this is a wake-up call. Is this really what we wanted? We wanted justice and we wanted fairness. And is this what we want when we have forgotten to see the old man or woman dying within 5 minutes of their death and we have them chained to a bed? Do we need to go to that extreme? What are they going to do there? Because you know what? You can chain their physical body, but their spirit is going to be free. so to be in spirituality. But is it this necessary, this degree of punishment, that a retribution, because retribution was possibly when a crime was committed, where somebody was really wanting to react against something else, and then someone else, some other situation in their life, where I have many trauma victims, especially ones of Vietnam vets, that get triggered. They get untreated sexual assault, and then they see a crime happening. They might click into something and murder somebody, and they're in the community, but they're trained to kill while they're in the army.
Right.
And so
right.
What do we want to do about that? So all these situations, can we say enough is enough? And can we say, what do we need as the alternative? We're so into the negative. So what do we need? We need peace and freedom, communities of peace. Can we even envision this positive world of which nobody has to experience a loss that when due to a crime that's committed for the many diversity of reasons? But
you're talking about the 60s. going back to the
60s. But if we don't want violence and crime, then what do we want? That's right, exactly. And I'm sitting here, I've got my PhD, I'm going to get tenure, and I'm thinking, well, what's the solution?
Right.
To me,
so what is, with 2 minutes remaining of our show, unfortunately, or 1 minute, what's the short-term goal you have and a long-term goal with regard to this issue in aging with prisoners?
Well, I'll end with my saying, which is my organization, be the evidence you want to see in the world. This is a takeoff on Gandhi's saying, whatever it is that you want to envision, your
be accountable.
And your passion, whatever it is for someone, be the change you want to see in the world. If you want something changed, then show evidence that you're doing it, but do something. And no matter what, speak out, no matter where you fall on this debate, but let's dialogue. I really encourage people to listen to the song, and I'd love to hear people's views, and you can totally, however you feel, it's like, whatever your thoughts are about it.
Can you also give us some contact information if people would like to get in touch with you with regard to any of your realms that you do want more information?
Sure.
They
can email me at tmashi, M-A-S-C-H-I, at Fordham, F-O-R-D-H-A-M .edu, or you can you go to the website www.bbevidence.org, and there's other contact information, including mailing information if you prefer to write me a letter. There's also the office phone number there, too. You can
okay, well, we will do that, and let's keep in touch, Tina. And unfortunately, this hour has gotten away from us. Perhaps we can do a follow-up at some point in the near future. Thank you. It's been such a pleasure. We've only scratched the surface. So
yes.
I think it's very valuable for us. So I wish everyone a good evening. And wait, next week we also have a wonderful guest coming up. Thank you very much, Delilah. And we're going to say good evening for this episode of Saturday.